And welcome back to another episode of Three Guys in a White Coat, a podcast where we give you our insight on the pathway to becoming a medical student. As always, I am Matt.
And I'm Matt as well.
And I'm Mike, and here comes the disclosure. Guys, remember, as we tell you every single time, these are not hard set rules. These are things for you guys to think about. Do not feel like you have to do every single thing you hear us talk about. Take these things with a grain of salt. They're just to get your brains working. We're going to try to just cut down that disclaimer because I'm getting sick of saying it every time.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you sounded like a little bit of a robot there. So
I know.
Almost going to get that recording down. But
I still want to use the Pirates of the Caribbean thing.
What would you call it? Guidelines. I know.
I've tried it. It doesn't jive in as well. I'll keep playing with it.
We'll have to look at, trademarking. Maybe I'll talk to Disney. See if I can use that. But today we are joined by Emily Hagen. And she is an M1 here at Stritch, and so she is going to tell us a little bit about her story and her pathway to medical school. So, Emily, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you went to college, and maybe what you majored in?
Sure. So, my name's Emily Hagen, and I am from Long Island, New York, and I attended Cornell University, where I graduated in 2017, and started school at Loyola this past August, and I'm now an M1.
There you go. Pretty fun. So,
New York. Enjoying M1 year so far? I know it's only been like a month and a half, but...
Yeah, it's great so far. Lots of amazing people, and Loyola's an awesome environment, and everyone's really welcoming and friendly, and it makes all the studying a lot better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Chicago to New York, what do you like?
they're really different. The pizza's also really different.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the most important question. Deep dish.
I was getting there.
Okay. Or thin crust.
It's hard to say, but I really like deep dish. I'm not tired of it yet.
Good.
I'm happy that there's a lot of it going around.
Excellent. Well, Emily, let's start this off. Do you have anyone who's like in medicine in your life, or talk to us about your kind of decision? At what point in your life you decided med school is where I'm aiming?
Sure. Okay. So I am one of those people that has always really wanted to be a doctor, and I haven't really strayed away from that. Throughout my life, I've had lots of experiences that have further confirmed my interest in medicine and in different ways based on these experiences. But the really initial spark that got me interested in medicine to begin with was actually a personal experience, in that when I was six, my father actually passed away from cancer, and that really just opened my eyes to what medicine was and the role of physicians and how important they are to the patient and their family. And I really also became perplexed by the human body and how all of a sudden, like, a seemingly healthy human body could become ill. And I just found that really, really interesting. So since being six, I've really always wanted to be a doctor. And although I don't have physicians in my immediate family, I am lucky to say that I've benefited from the mentorship of a few uncles and cousins who are physicians. So I definitely have a lot of other relatives in my family who have shown me how great medicine is and have mentored me along the way.
Great. That's awesome. I mean, that's so cool. I love when, like, there's a really, like, profound interest throughout the life. There was never anything else that kind of tempted you away from medicine, even in college or anything?
Yeah. So I guess out of consideration, I like toyed with nursing or PA for some bit.
Yeah.
Really in high school for the most part, where I was like, oh, maybe I should explore these other related careers before I go into college thinking I want to apply to medical school for sure. And before I take all these difficult classes and so on. So in high school, I shadowed, I think, just like once or twice in nurse and PA and liked it. But in the end of the day, still wanted to be a physician. And I went into medical school. I mean, I went into college a little open-minded in that I was like, okay, like I'll take these pre-med classes, but I'll not close doors. So the summer after My freshman year in college, I did this pre-med program, and I told myself that throughout the program, I would keep my eyes open to the roles of other healthcare providers and explore those careers further if I so wanted. But throughout the program, I, you know, fell in love with the role of physicians and therefore came back to it. So I really didn't stray that far.
Cool.
So a program like that, that was while you were in college?
Yes.
Okay, so that, and that was separate from college. Like, you found something like in like your summer or something that you did that?
So the program was actually through my college.
Okay.
It was called the Cornell Urban Summer Program. And it was called Urban Summer because the program took place in Manhattan, New York, actually where Cornell's medical college is.
Gotcha.
And it was an amazing program. It consisted of different shadowing opportunities and a course that ran throughout the whole summer. And there were some community service activities involved. And it was just overall a very eye-opening experience to what the field of medicine entails and what physicians do, as well as an introduction to various social problems surrounding the healthcare system and ethical issues. And it definitely made me really excited about wanting to be a physician.
That's awesome. That's such a cool experience. Did you guys have those kinds of things at your college as well?
I don't remember ever having anything like that.
No?
Okay. No. I mean, but again, like, we've talked about this a lot. Like, I think, I mean, my school was 45,000 people with probably 5,000 pre-meds.
Sure.
It's hard to put something like that in place in a school that, like, there's already that many people trying to go in there.
Yeah, and at Northeastern, we didn't have anything like that either. The closest thing we had to that was an EMT program where you could go like work on an ambulance and like help take care of any of the kids that got sick at school or anyone who may have partied a little too hard and you needed to go make sure that they were okay.
That was you a lot of the time, right? They had to come take care of you.
No disclosure. I plead the fifth or whatever the heck that number is. But
that's the fifth.
Then we also had like our pre-med department was really good. Like they just helped get us on like on the co-op schedule and all that. So I kind of feel like I did have a similar thing, but it wasn't like a program that we did on our own. I was asking you because I know that there are programs that you can do outside of college to like go do that kind of stuff, so I wasn't sure if this was like an outside thing or through your school, but that's cool.
So I will add though that I also did another pre-med program outside of my college my last summer of college, so I can really speak to both sides. But working chronologically, I just discussed the program through Cornell first because that took place first and was part of the experience of considering other careers before.
How'd you find these programs? Because like I said, we don't have that. Wisconsin doesn't have that. How'd you find, it's nice that you had the one through school. How'd you reach out and find the other one that wasn't offered through your school? Or did you just hear about it from somebody?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually heard of the program that I did outside of college from my own dermatologist
who was
affiliated with the medical school that held this program. And he had mentioned to me, I think even when I was like a senior in high school and I was telling him where I was going to school and what I wanted to study and how I wanted to be a physician. And he said, oh, well, in a few years, you really should consider doing this program. I've had a lot of past patients and family friends who I've told this program to, and all of them have loved it and have been really successful in applying to medical school. So really keep this in the back of your head. I did, and that's how I learned about it. And since he told me, I then learned about a few other students in my town older than me who did the program as well and heard really great firsthand accounts of it.
That's awesome. Yes. So, I mean, tell me about like a little bit about the, like the class profile or demographic for those kind of classes. I mean, do you see that they're mostly upperclassmen or like freshmen, sophomores in college?
Right. So the Cornell Urban Summer Program that I did was definitely a diverse collection of students.
Sure.
Students ranging from just finishing their freshman year to entering their senior year participated in the program.
Okay, cool.
And from what I saw, I think that depending on where you were in school affected the experiences that you had and what you took from it. So someone like me who was just 1 year in college didn't quite have all the science classes under my belt to like see more so like the clinical applications of what I was learning while shadowing, but yet I was able to really test the waters and gain a better understanding of if medicine was something I wanted to pursue. Sure. Whereas a senior in college might be 100% set on medicine at this point, like perhaps even working on their application at the same time.
Gotcha.
And just shadowing for additional experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Whereas the program I did outside of Cornell, my senior year going into college was definitely heavy on upperclassmen.
Okay.
I think the program even required that you had to be going into your junior year.
Gotcha.
And I did it going into my senior year. And having participated in the program, it made so much sense that it was restricted to older students because of the things we learned about and really just the fact that you could get so much more out of it being more knowledgeable and further along in college.
So you said, yeah, you get a lot more out of it. What was the biggest difference that you noticed between the two programs? Because like you said, they're obviously like keying into like people that are seniors, they're probably applying next year versus like freshmen, sophomores trying to figure out what it's like.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that the main difference was that by my summer going into senior year, I had gained a bunch of experiences in between freshman year and senior year that I was able to integrate into my thoughts and knowledge gained throughout the program. For instance, I had taken a few medical ethics classes by this point, so I was able to draw from those classes to some patient encounters that I saw, and I was also able to draw from things I learned about in the first program I did, such as the like the importance of communication and professionalism in the patient encounter and the importance of eye contact and cultural competence and all these things that I had learned about before from classes in the first program. And therefore I was able to see these things come to light in the second program and really appreciated that. Whereas in the first program, it was more just me wanting to see as much as I could see and learn as much as I could learn, not knowing what I would take away from it.
Interesting. Sure.
So one thing I want to ask you, because we've had people ask us about this in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So you, from like a young age, kind of thought this is something you want to do. You had this thought through high school and then into college.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever question it once you were in the college path, or did you love the classes and you were just like, nope, this is solidified it. I'm doing it.
I would say there were definitely times throughout college where I lost sight of my end goals. So knowing deep down, yes, that I wanted to be a physician, I knew, but in the heat of really difficult college classes like physics and organic chemistry, I think found myself thinking, oh, wow, these classes are really hard. Like, is this all worth it?
Yeah.
You know, I could be having more fun. I could be taking these like more enjoyable, less rigorous classes.
Yeah.
You know,
think
maybe
about that today.
Yeah. Like maybe I should do that. But then I guess every time came back to realizing, okay, I want to be a physician. I know that getting into medical school requires these classes. I just have to go through them. And even though I may not see why, you know, this organic reaction is important for applying to medical school, I'm just going to trust the system and get through it. And yeah, try to hold on to those thoughts.
Yeah, I ask that because a lot of the students that are like freshmen right now or, you know, in high school trying to see if this is what they want to do, they'll ask us and be like, I'm taking these classes and I hate this. Like, and we try to kind of tell them like, yes, you have to do these to get like the background knowledge to get to where you want to get to. And that we don't all always love all these things.
Right. I think you pointed out a great thing, like medical school, being a physician is very, very long-term payoff. It is an investment in every shape of, you know, like whether that's monetarily to go to med school or, you know, just these classes, you have to always be thinking about the long-term, being like, this is going to pay off in the future. So that's a really great point you brought up.
Yeah. Do you have anything?
No.
Oh, okay.
He did good.
What was your friend group like in college? Did you have like a lot of pre-med friends, or was it like hard to have people that weren't pre-med friends because they didn't understand your study schedule? Talk us through that.
Sure. Yeah, it was hard finding that balance between pre-med friends and non-pre-med friends and who understood and who didn't. So I'll do my best to answer this question, but I would say that I had pre-med friends that I became friends with through school. So we studied together, go to the same classes, sit next to each other in class, and therefore became friends and could vent to them about the hard exam, could vent to them about, you know, how hard this class is, et cetera. I would say that non-pre-med friends came into the picture mainly through joining a sorority. So that was, you know, there were no academic
requirements
there. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Like, didn't matter what you were studying, didn't matter what career you were oriented towards, nothing like that. So the friends that I developed relationships with through my sorority were entirely just based on us forming connections outside of school.
Sure.
So all my non-pre-med friends really came from my sorority, and so that was really helpful. And throughout developing relationships with them, I still maintained my friendships with my pre-med friends. But it was hard because being pre-med, you're really busy, and you can't go to every sorority event. You can't go to every social event. And it was hard to say no to things knowing that, you know, you wanted to go, but knowing that you felt like you couldn't. And I would say that over time, I got better at saying no to things,
sure,
as well as feeling less guilty about saying no, mm-hmm, knowing that you had to prioritize and it's
you
okay.
You had a goal in mind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If you can't go to everything, it's going to be okay. So I would say that I just had to hold on to the idea that maybe my pre-med friends don't understand, but that's okay because I know that I and making the best decision for myself right now.
Yeah, and like that's kind of like always what we talk about is like the internal struggle. Like you want to hang out. Like, I mean, you have the people that are going through the classes and like are on your schedule, but sometimes there is that, you know, inner part of us that is always like comparing each other with, you know, subconsciously. Definitely. And that can be hard versus like people that aren't in the pre-med group, which there's no comparison. They don't even know what's going on in that term, but then they also just have different priorities like you're talking about.
Right.
So yeah,
definitely
that can be tough.
Agree.
Yeah, so moving away from that and into a different kind of conversation. So you did these programs while you were at school and all that. I'm assuming all of that went on to like your AMCAS application later.
Yes.
What are some things you did outside of those programs that went on your AMCAS? Like, did you have any research background? Did you have any volunteering that like you like really meant something to you? Like, what did that part of the AMCAS look like for you?
Sure. I would say that big part of my application was the research that I conducted while in college, as well as my job after graduating during the two gap years that I took. So first, to discuss the research I did during college, I was a human development major, which is basically a combination of psychology, social science, and some biology. And I was able to work on a few research projects with one particular human development professor that I started.
Bless you.
Bless you.
Thank you.
That's twice now. You did that in the last one, too.
I know, I'm sorry.
Are these making you allergic?
I'm allergic to you.
Sorry, continue, Emily.
You're good. That I started at the beginning of my junior year of college. So this research, there were a few different research topics involved here. So the first one I'll describe was ethical reasoning in the context of medicine. So with this professor, I devised a survey that I administered to about 100 Cornell students that was examining different factors that affect one's ability to engage in ethical reasoning.
Wow. That's kind of crazy. Like, how did you come up with those questions?
So I surveyed a handful of physicians, some of them in my family, and gave them a set of ethical scenarios that were informed by research I did in pursuing the literature on what composes commonly found ethical dilemmas in medicine. So I asked them to rate these dilemmas on the basis of difficulty and reality. How likely is it that a physician will actually encounter such a scenario based on what you know as a physician.
Sure.
So I compared all of the responses to decide which scenarios to actually put on the survey instrument, as in which ones were deemed to be valid based on these physicians' input.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So after doing that, which was the very first step, I had the scenarios that I would put on the survey. And then I also had a whole slew of questions about the participant himself or herself. So what grade are they in school? What were their SAT and or ACT scores? What is their GPA so far? Have they ever taken a class in ethics? Do they watch medical dramas?
Oh, yeah.
Questions like that. So I administered the survey over several months, then collected the data and analyzed it, and then wrote a paper on it, which was not published, but it definitely was a great experience, and I learned so much from it. And I vividly remember my professor saying that he thinks that what I found is great.
Yeah.
Like work for someone else to pursue later on, and whether it's through his lab or someone he tells about or someone else down the line, that it could be potentially valid work. But whether or not it ends up being used doesn't matter so much to me. More so, it was what I gained from the experience, both sure, yeah, on how to conduct research, but also the thoughts I gained about the whole topic of ethical reasoning in medicine and how intrigued I was by it.
Especially when it comes to like an interview. So I think something that people kind of get misconstrued is, if you didn't publish it, you can't talk about it. And that's not true.
Definitely not true.
You can 100% talk about what you just said in an interview. And that shows that, yes, maybe it didn't get published, but you were the one doing it. You were the driving force behind it. It shows commitment. It shows the ability to accomplish a task. I mean, if you publish it, great. Like that's awesome. Like it's great to be able to put that on your CV. But I think we're all in the same boat about this, but
yeah.
I don't think that that's like an end all be all.
It's basically just showing that you can have a project from start to finish. I think that's the biggest thing. Or if you can get something, you have the idea, you're coming up with it. Like you said, you're doing the work, like you're driving the work. And then I think even more important than that, can you pass it on to someone? Like if it's not finished before you're done, can you leave it in a spot where, like you said, if they're going to keep doing this work in that lab, can you leave it in a spot where they can pick it up and just go with it?
Right.
Yeah. And I think like the pressure on the AMCAS application in general is to put on these things that are, you know, quantifiable as like, you know, like achievements, as in like I have one of these and it was blah blah blah. But I think more so it's you should be putting on their meaningful experiences, like regardless of what they are, because it's about what the experience meant to you
and how you can explain its meaning.
Absolutely. And how that developed you. I mean, it's an ethical, you know, medical ethics, which is an amazing field, and I think we need more of that,
which we also have a department here.
Yeah, I was gonna say, introduce that to that program here at all?
Yeah, I have learned about the program, and I'm considering either the bioethics honors program or perhaps even the master's.
Sure.
Oh, nice. So definitely going to take advantage of the bioethics opportunities.
That's great.
Here.
Yeah. That's great. So where did the ethics interest develop from?
Yeah, I can't really pinpoint one exact experience, honestly, but I would trace it back to the classes that I began to take in college that really opened my eyes to ethical reasoning and medical ethics. It was really the class I took called Ethical Challenges in the Brain and Behavioral Sciences at Cornell with the professor with whom I later conducted research with.
Sure.
And that wasn't specific to medicine or anything, but it really just opened my eyes to the fact that so many ethical dilemmas can occur in professional settings and in academia, and how do we go about handling them, and what logical, you know, steps do we take to handle them? What factors should affect our decision making? How do we, you know, approach people when trying to handle them? I just found all of these situations so interesting. And then when taking later classes specifically on medical ethics, where I saw these ethical frameworks come to light in the context of medicine, I was just blown away, because I was like, wow, as a physician, not only am I, you know, taking care of patients, but really also grappling with these medical dilemmas that are so fascinating and also really important to understand how to handle.
For sure. I mean, and that's the thing, is like, we never know what's going to come through the door. Like, it could be, right. you know, it could be a standard disease, or like maybe a very common disease, the patient situation can be completely different. So definitely. I think that's a really, really cool thing to always be learning about. So that's amazing research experience. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
So before we move forward, Sems, was there something that you wanted to ask her?
Do you remember, like, did you guys have to take that one exam to get in that was like the 30-minute exam?
Oh, yeah.
You like had to write down.
Casper. And it was videotaped.
So here's a question I always have, because I went into that exam, and like, they don't tell you how they're going to grade it. Mm-hmm. They don't tell you, you're never going to get your grade.
Right.
How did you grade the responses? Because I feel like in those surveys, there's not really like, well, there is a right answer. I mean, you don't say like, if someone like comes in, you're not going to like not treat them, but it's more like how you work around the answer.
Yeah.
Right. So...
Did you have to take that?
I did take Casper. And
that was probably really fun for you.
I took it too.
I did too.
I think it was a Loyola thing. I think certain schools required it.
I don't remember if Loyola did. I honestly think that they didn't, which is surprising given, you know, Loyola's mission and landscape here.
Sure.
But
probably worked out well. I don't think I did that well.
But we'll all never know how we did.
What do you say about your ethical code, Matthew?
Well, considering 8 of the 10 schools that I applied to had it, and I didn't get interviews from any one of them.
Ouch. Okay. Well, thanks for sharing.
So just to kind of wrap back to the Casper thing. So for those of you that are out there that don't know what Casper is, some schools require you to take this. It's an ethics test or something like that.
It's like an ethical reasoning exam. It's scenarios based, which is the try and true way of ethical reasoning to be assessed in like standardized fashion. And these scenarios were not in the context of medicine.
Yeah, no, they're completely unmet. I think I remember one where someone comes in and like you're like a boss or a manager at
Your boss is gone, I think, in this one. Are you talking about the one where like you're trying to give the person money to like
There was one where like I had a choice between hiring someone who was like a perfect candidate for the job, but like had tattoo sleeves and like piercings all over their face, and like they would be in front of clients all the time.
A whole nother topic,
right? Yeah. So like that was like one of the scenarios. Like I was like, oh my lord! And then you have 3 minutes.
It's kind of a leading question.
Yeah,
like some people might not find that as an ethical dilemma because they would just say, oh, I would view them entirely based on their credentials and the interview as I normally would. Who's to say that their tattoos should be a barring factor?
But again, you probably explain it in your answer.
You have to.
I mean, you can't say like, no.
Right.
Like, I remember they always had the one where it was like, you're in a group and like someone comes in drunk. Like, what do you do?
Yeah. Like, obviously.
You can't just say, I would do X. You have to explain.
Right. Right. So talk us like through from, you know, someone who has done research in medical ethics. What's your approach to a scenario such as like, you don't have to use those as examples, but like, what's your approach?
The approach I used in my survey?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So going off your guys' questions both about this, it was challenging to grade the scenarios for the reasons that have come up in our conversation, that there's no right answer. It's subjective, of course. And how do you distinguish what's a good answer and what's a bad answer?
Sure.
So how I laid it out for my study was that students' responses would be assessed based on the number of possible actions they described in their responses. So how all of my scenarios were worded and set up, I asked them to explain what options they would consider taking in their response. So the scenarios were all in the context of medicine, and I specifically said in them, you are a medical student, you are a physician, you are a professor, etc.
Yeah.
So then at the end of every scenario then said, what would you do? What are the options you would consider and why?
Okay.
So something like in different words, but that's essentially what it asked. Mm-hmm. And so I assessed how many options they considered in their response and how well they were explained.
Gotcha.
So going off what you guys were saying before, you can't just say, I would report them. You have to explain why.
Gotcha.
So if you had them come in and say, like, well, I would look at this, and if this didn't work out, or, like, this wasn't the case, then I would go this way, or if it was, then I would go this path.
I think I probably went way too many directions on the gas. I was probably like, well, I would do this, and then if that didn't happen, I'd go to this, and then from there, I'd go to here, and then from there, I'd go to here.
Someone told me that, like, they didn't have a real answer for anyone. They just, like, kept typing and was like, well, if this happens, I do this. If this happens, mm-hmm. I do this. If it's not, I do this.
Yeah, I feel like I just brain dumped on
it. I don't know, but from what Emily's saying, it sounds like it's not about the way that you answer. It's about how you answer, more so. And I mean,
not the way, but how?
You know, that's a good question. Not like,
I get what you mean.
It's not about the end goal. It's about the journey.
It's not what you decide, right, per se. It's more about how you are able to rationalize or explain.
Exactly.
Sure. No,
exactly.
You.
So that was what I was looking at, and that's what I was assessing based on. And myself and another individual reviewed all of the students' responses so that they could be assessed for what's called inter-rater reliability, as in my word or someone else's word isn't the end-all be-all. So if there were discrepancies, that was further explored to add validity to the data.
Very cool. So, for those of you taking the Casper test, make sure that you with the time allotted, are able to decide concisely, but also explain those decisions well enough to where that they have meaningful significance.
Great.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, also look some stuff up on them, because they were fairly new when I applied. And they've been around for more, so there's probably a lot more information about it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was not a lot of information when I took it, so.
Cool.
Right. Yeah, I think it's been used for a few years now. I took it this past summer, and at the time, there was this book that I found on Amazon, I believe. It was very, very short, maybe $10. It was a pink cover. I unfortunately don't know exactly what it was called, but it had
it
had some scenarios and just got you thinking in the way that you were encouraged to think for the exam. So I found it helpful just to quickly look at this book.
Cool. Well, again, like, that was a great detour through medical ethics with Emily. So tell us about your volunteer experience. Did you have any meaningful volunteer experiences that you liked?
I did. I really was able to focus on volunteering after I graduated from college.
Okay.
I unfortunately didn't have all the time that I would have wanted to have spent in volunteering activities during college.
Sure, sure.
As, you know, we've talked about so far, I did a lot of shadowing and wanted to gain more community service experience after I graduated.
Yeah.
So after graduating from college, I volunteered through Crisis Text Line, which is an organization committed to providing mental health care for any individuals of any age, ethnicity, SES, etc.
Interesting.
In that all the people who want this mental health support have to do is text in to Crisis Text Line at any time, and it's entirely free. Wow. So my role in this was being what's called a crisis text line counselor, in that I was on the receiving end and I texted with individuals who needed some form of support.
Wow.
So I went through the training for that during my gap year and then served as a counselor, which was extremely meaningful.
I can imagine. That's amazing. So how did you get involved with this? How did you hear about this?
Yeah, so I actually heard about the opportunity through my pre-med advisor, who had recommended this opportunity to various other pre-med students, knowing that it is entirely related to medicine and very meaningful. And based on my advisor hearing great experiences from these students that had done it, she continued to tell other students about it, including myself.
Sure.
That's cool.
There were also some New York Times articles published over the years about Crisis Text Line and how much it's meant to people and how many lives it has saved.
That's incredible.
Is it a nationwide thing then?
Mm-hmm. It actually, over the summer, reached England.
Oh, wow.
I believe, just England. But up until then, since it started, I believe 10-ish years ago, it's been just in the U.S.
Oh, wow. That's really incredible. I mean, I can't even imagine, like, how many people. It's like you said, it's the access. Like, now everyone has a phone.
Exactly.
You know, they do the same thing with, like, the suicide helpline. You can just call in and then talking to someone right away. Like, I can't imagine how many people that, like, is reaching have access to it.
I was going to say. Right. That's really cool.
Now so many really young teenagers have cell phones and, you know, may not be able to call into a suicide line because they're with their parents more often than a grown adult is, you know.
That's a really great point.
They're at school, you know, every day.
Yeah.
They can't get up from class and call, like, but perhaps during recess when, you know, some really triggering event happens and they have their cell phone, they can text someone for help. They don't have to call and make it a larger deal.
Yeah. No, that's great.
So, like, do you have to, do you like follow up, or is there like a patient handoff, or talk me through that.
Sure. So if you're volunteering and your shift ends or you have to go, but you're in the middle of a conversation, you pass the conversation on to another volunteer at the time. If your conversation ends with your texter, you end the conversation, there's no follow-up. So you can never, the volunteer can never initiate a conversation with the texter again. Even if you want to see how they're doing or ask them how, you know, the plan that you discussed actually went. Mm-hmm. You can't ever do that.
Yeah, that's probably, that's a good safety measure for, you know, obviously volunteers as well, who probably can get very emotionally invested.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you don't want to get attached to that. Like, you want to make sure that, like, in the moment you're there helping, but you don't want that to become something that's, like, more than what it was meant to be.
Sure. Absolutely. It's
probably a huge HIPAA violation too. So.
Well, I mean, there's a role. Right. There's a role to be played, and obviously, you know, it's a system that works for a reason.
Yeah,
so, exactly.
Yeah, it's a great setup.
And so, another thing that we like to talk about, so, you know, we know about the things you did when you're in college, and we know about your research now. What are some just, like, activities that you may have put on your AMCAS application that, you know, may not have been, like, quote-unquote medically relevant, but you felt like were important that you wanted to have on there?
Sure. I, just briefly, I think, in one of the last of the 15 activities that you're allowed to describe, I talked about how I really like to journal. So in a sense, it is medically related in that I described in the blurb on the AMCAS about how with all of my shadowing experiences, I would journal about them.
Yeah.
And I just love that sense of reflection and the space to make these connections and describe my thoughts and emotions and processing what I saw. And then also journaling in general, wherever I could. So in college, and like over the summers and really just whenever I found the time to, I enjoyed journaling. So I wrote about that as one of my activities, which many people would probably say, oh, why bother putting that on? Like, that doesn't
that's a great thing
make
to have
you a better candidate. But it was important to me, and I know that I gained a lot from it.
Yeah.
And it informed a lot of my thoughts about medicine and a lot of my, like, personal reflections on life in general.
Yeah.
So I put it.
I think, honestly, like, those kinds of things can help you stand out as a candidate because, you know, everyone has the shadowing experiences. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have research or volunteering. But, like, you know, I think we've talked about in other interviews with someone had this random thing that they really liked, really were passionate about, whether that's horseback riding or something else. You know, again, it's a meaningful experience to you, and it makes you who you are. So I think that's a really, really cool thing.
Yeah, you can't be afraid to put those things on there. So we always like to try and highlight that.
No. Yeah, it's definitely important to keep in mind that if it's not shadowing or not research or not volunteering, that doesn't mean it can't go on there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, if an applicant makes the conscious decision to spend their time doing this, it's for a reason.
Yeah.
And you know, it's obviously meaningful to you.
Yeah.
And that's what that section of the AMCAS is for.
You learn something from everything. That's what I feel like it comes down to with this kind of stuff. So don't be afraid to throw that on. But
it makes you who you are, too.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
I mean, now that we're on the title of the topic of the application, we kind of want to talk to you about something that I know gave me a lot of stress. I think it gives a lot of people kind of stress, like how to approach secondaries.
Mm.
And so I know we talked to you before that you were filling out a lot of them. So how did you approach that? Like, did you just, I know some people that
some people
do them
some
right
people
away,
like have like anecdotes that they write down.
Yep. Yeah. Like they do them right away. Or some people like, they, you know, copy and paste and like adjust. How did you approach like doing secondaries?
Yeah, it was definitely a project.
Yeah.
It definitely took a lot of time, effort, energy, patience. It's hard because there's no right way of going about it. Everyone's right. different. Everyone works at different paces. But what was really important to me was being really timely.
Okay.
So from the beginning, like before secondaries came out, I knew that I wanted to stay on top of them. Like I wanted to turn them in really quickly, and I didn't want the time factor, at least in my head, to be a reason for why I didn't get an interview or why I didn't get into the school. Like I wanted to know that I was as timely as possible because sure. from what I heard, timing is of the essence when you mm-hmm. apply.
Yeah. It's like comedy. Timing is everything.
Yes.
Yeah. So I had heard, made you laugh.
heard story after story about people turning in secondaries late and that not working in their favor. So I was like, I do not want to have that experience.
Did you give yourself a time then? Like, did you say like, I need to finish this in a week or like 2 weeks or the day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So I had a spreadsheet, which I highly recommend using, which covered a bunch of different aspects involved. So I had a column for the school's name. I had a column for the date, the date I received the secondary. I had a column for my goal date to submit it.
Nice.
I had a column that asked like long, short, medium so that I could know how rough
time it was going to take.
Roughly it would take because some secondaries are a lot longer than others.
Some it's like one question, some it's 12. Yeah.
Exactly. And then I also had columns that asked me for my username and password for the portal.
Perfect. I was just writing that down because I was like, we need to make sure we throw that in. Because you get so many.
So many. And it would take so much time to go to your email every time to find the link, to find your username, to open like a book, whatever your case is, wherever you write it. A random post-it that you wrote it on.
Honestly.
I at least needed it in a specific place. I think that saved so much time.
Yeah.
It was just a little thing that I think was super helpful.
Oh, for sure.
Agreed. I'm so glad you just said that. Because minute you started talking about your Excel sheet, it reminded me of mine. And because like your passwords are always like your name with like a couple like weird like letters after them. And like the other one, like UVM's is like basically the same thing as like NYU's, but NYU's just like a W instead of a V. And you're like, how do I remember that?
Right. It's like your name, last three of your social, plus like the third born digit of your birthday, third letter of your middle name.
Sometimes they let you change them. Sometimes they don't.
Right.
I was like, no, too messy.
Great. Yeah, that's a great advice.
Yeah, so the table PTSD. Was a lifesaver and was super helpful for planning the secondary. So to answer your question, it helped a lot with the figuring out of the timing.
Yeah, organization is everything for those, for sure. Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, who gave you advice? Like, did you have, I know you said some family members that were physicians giving you advice on these. I know you talked about, to us, about an advisor that you had. Talk us through about who was kind of mentoring you through this process and who did you have read these?
Sure. I used a privatized advisor, for everything medical school related.
Excellent.
Ranging
okay.
from the secondaries to getting ready for interviews to the personal statement.
Sure.
And it was a very thoughtful decision, and I'm so glad I made that decision. And really, like, the table was my advisor's idea. So really, I was guided at every step of the way.
That's
and
really helpful.
Gained a lot of insight and help through this advisor, and was fortunate to have picked up advice as well from family members and friends of mine who were in medical school or just applied to medical school. I had a lot of pre-med friends and acquaintances from college who were so willing to help. So from all of these sources, I picked up pieces of advice here and there, but having this advisor was extremely instrumental.
Yeah. So talking about that, it's kind of cool. So, I mean, I'm sure having a, you know, someone that's personally with you instead of maybe, I mean, I know at my school, even I went to a small school and there was still, you know, probably maybe 50 to 70 kids for each pre-med advisor. Mm-hmm. So like they want to help as much as they can, obviously, but with
time
so
is limited.
Many kids. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a really cool, I mean, like, I didn't even know that that kind of existed. So
no, I never heard of that
definitely.
Either.
Mm-hmm.
Summer, do you think like coming from an, like also coming from a big school, do you think that's something that like you like might've thought about?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
If I actually knew it was out there, 100%.
Go back in time, slap yourself.
I think it's just like you have such like more personalized advice. And so like my problem was is that there were five or six advisors. So you got in and you got to see them. But every time you saw them, you had to re-explain your whole application, which mm-hmm. took 30 minutes. And then you get 10 minutes of time to actually talk about it. So that's great because you guys can basically just start right there and be like, well, I did this. And it's like, okay, great. That's good. Like next step. Now you can work on this.
So exactly.
Like, that's so helpful.
The personal attention was huge. And like you said, not having to explain your situation and story every time you spoke. I can't imagine every time having to remind them what was the last conversation you just had? Where does that essay stand, et cetera?
Yeah.
You know, having that one-on-one relationship where they know, where the advisor knows you and your story and your passions for medicine and your strengths and your weaknesses in so many dimensions is so helpful.
Yeah. So that's great. I mean, like if for those of you listening out there that go to a big school and maybe have had issues or maybe not even had any issues with pre-med advisors, you know, for
just
no
too
reason,
big,
but just want that closer relationship.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of, you know, intimate relationship at that point is crucial because I mean, they can provide insights. So definitely a great option to look into. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah,
that.
Of course. I, you know, can only speak from my experience, but sure. It was so helpful and really important to me that I had that close relationship and personalized attention and didn't feel like I was one of 1,000 students that they were helping and really benefited immensely from that.
Yeah, awesome. No, I'd heard that kind of stuff for like...
yeah, here we are.
I'd heard about that for like personal statements and all that, but that's kind of cool. That's a nice little avenue to think about. Like,
yeah.
If it's just something that you want, like it's out there.
Yeah.
So that's you cool. talked a lot about, you had a lot of people giving you advice between your mentors and you said you have friends who have gone through the entire mm-hmm. pathway, family members. What mm-hmm. was the best piece of advice that you got going through the application process?
Okay. So it's hard to pinpoint like one specific lesson or piece of advice I got because I think the main reason is that I asked for advice like at every step of the way with applying to med school. So I asked a lot of people for advice, for instance, on the gap year and navigating the gap year search process and what, you know, what composes a quote unquote good gap year job and, you know, what should a gap year for med school look like? So I talked to a lot of people about that. And then also when applying to med school with the essays, I talked to a lot of people about like how many schools to apply to and advice for interviewing, really so many dimensions. But what comes to mind for really great advice actually comes from an M4 at Loyola who I got in touch with when applying to med school through a relative. And when talking about applying to med school in general, he told me that when applying to med school, which is a very arduous process, it's really important to stay busy, stay the course, and stay positive.
Yeah.
And I think all three of those things were so important when applying and really, really sets one up for success because it's so easy to get disappointed and disheartened throughout the process, getting rejection email after rejection email after rejection mm-hmm. email and going into an interview and not thinking that you did well or like getting a score back, not thinking you did well. I can never be a doctor, like sure. all these hard things. It's really easy to become negative.
Persistence pays off though.
Yeah. Exactly.
Positivity, mm-hmm. perseverance, everything. That's such a great message to, you know, push.
Exactly. And then also knowing that like, even if you, you know, are happy with, or, you know, at least satisfied with your gap, your job, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't keep like doing things that you love or reaching out to doctors to see if you can shadow them or talk to them or, you know, what volunteering experiences exist in your town for how to get involved in something that gets you excited, whatever the case may be, just keeping busy because depending on everyone's situation, this varies, but it could be really important to update schools later on and to let them know that you've done all these really meaningful things to you I think is really great for them to hear. So staying busy is important throughout the process.
I think that's one of the most important things is that like they told me this, like, don't just like not do anything.
Yeah.
Like, have fun. Like, you're still a person too. We always go back to like, you're still a person.
Yeah.
You're still who you are.
And before Sems, I let you like start to wrap this up. I just want to open it up one more thing. Do you have any last things that you want to talk about? Anything that we didn't get to that you were like burning to like get out?
I would just say the idea that like being pre-med is really hard, and it's really hard to compare yourself to others and get, you know, overwhelmed and get disappointed when stumbling blocks and challenges occur. But it's really important to remind yourself of why you want to go to medical school in the first place, and, you know, to stay positive and to do things because you want to, not because they look good.
We didn't pay her to say that. I swear we didn't pay her.
No, I can attest that you guys didn't. And it's really easy to, you know, to look for a research experience because you're like, oh, I haven't had one yet. I need one to get into medical school.
And this will look good. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. And, you know, I knew in college that having research was quote unquote important, but an opportunity fell on my lap and I thought it sounded amazing. And then it ended up, surprisingly becoming a huge passion of mine and informing what I want to do as a physician.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have occurred if I don't think, had that mindset of, oh, this sounds great, like, let me try it, rather than like, oh, I need to actively seek out a research experience and then say I did that and I found one that I didn't really like, but it was research, so I did it.
Yeah.
And then I didn't gain as much, so I wouldn't have gained as much. So just do things because you're passionate, not because you think you need to do them.
I didn't pay for the passionate either.
No, he didn't.
Like you said, like, you get so much more out of the things that you care about rather than just forcing yourself to do something for a check on a box.
Yeah. And admissions officers can tell.
Yes, they can. Mm-hmm. Especially in an interview.
Yeah.
So
Emily, thank you so much for coming on here.
It was great to talk to you guys.
Yeah, it's great having an M1 perspective. I don't think we've had an M1 perspective yet.
She's the first one.
She's the first.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm honored.
So we have like kind of a little way that we sign off. So just kind of follow our lead. We know you'd do great. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not too complex.
Well, that's what I thought too when I screwed up last time. Anyway.
I'll try.
Thank you guys all for listening. As always, this is Semler signing off.
This is Matt signing off.
This is Mike signing off.
This is Emily signing off.
Right. Awesome.
Thanks, guys.